We're continuing. We spoke about a few weeks ago already, before Yom Tov started, the topic of Minhagim in general, and how one of the major messages of our first Mishnah is Hakol Kemineg HaMedina. And we explored a few things, such as the source of the concept of Minig, possible distinctions and possible integrations between Minig in the context of Mamonos and Minig in the context of other things. And so we'll come back to that today, but we'll also find that this will very much interweave with issues of Yom Tovim, issues that we spoke about yesterday regarding the Darim. All of it is interrelated, and we'll be able to build and continue. So if you recall, when we focused on Minhagim, so at our last shiur about that, so we talked about the fact that on the surface it seems like Minig in the context of Mamonos and Minig in the context of ritual, of mitzvos, really come from different places and have different concepts. But there are a lot of connections between them, and it's not clear whether they are wholly distinct. So I think the note that we ended on last time was that the Tzad HaShavah should be Nehem, so if we want to see them really as all connected, it's that the halacha does put a big weight on what people do. And certainly we put a huge weight on revealed wisdom of Torah and on formal enactments of Chazal. But on top of that also, what people do is also significant, and not in an absolute sense. It could be that we may find that what people do is based either on a mistake or on something that was tied into a certain set of circumstances that don't continue to persist. But at least as a default starting position, there is the presumption of wisdom to what Jews do and to what people do in general. And we start off with a default of deference to that. And it may turn out to be that is what to discuss, but that starts off as something significant, and that is the Tzad HaShavah, both in the context of Dinei Mamonos for a number of reasons. And we talked about whether it's because of the presumption that that's the understanding between people when two people enter into a business relationship or a neighboring relationship. The assumption is they're functioning based on what the minig is, and maybe that's the understanding. Or is it because there's some kind of a communal enactment? And that I gave you a little bit more to look at this morning. I saw the Gemaras on Daf Zayin and Daf Ches, which bring a little bit more detail to that concept. Or is it something more based on some kind of Torah value in the same kind of context as we find by other types of Minhagim? But there are a range of possibilities in that context of Dinei Mamonos and in the context of other areas of Halacha. So the assumption that a Minig probably, at least by default assumption, has some kind of a reflection of a halachic value in it, and therefore we should take it seriously. So that seems to tie them together. So I think we left off noting that in the context of Yom Kippur, and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, so we find that the piyutim that are said are clearly not Torah law or even rabbinic law, but they're a function of minig. And therefore, we should be very careful with them. And that's what it says in Shulchan Aruch, that we should have great reverence and care not to discard piyutim and not to change that casually. And as we've experienced, certainly last year, this year, maybe to different degrees, halacha l'maisa, this became a very significant point because COVID causing the need to keep the minyanim shorter, to keep the services briefer, so then the question of what is indispensable and what can be cut becomes a very practical question. So the role of these piyutim has been extensively discussed. So in light of the fact that the minig to say whatever is said in the respective communities is something that is taken very seriously. And the Vilna Gaon has a comment over there where he says that, yes, ta'akol kemineg HaMedina, and referencing the Gemara in Bava Metzia, which one of the major sources for the importance within Dinei Mamonos of Minig. So ostensibly creating a connection there between our Dinei Mamonos context. Right there, if you recall, that was the reference to employer-employee relationships. When somebody is hired, the expectation that the Minig is going to direct what the terms of employment are. So that one could have thought that's just because there is a deal between them. But it's interesting that the Vilna Gaon is associating that with Putin. So what does that tell us about a possible relationship between the two? So it's interesting, Rav Asher Weiss, in that essay, which I think I sent out last time when we spoke about it then, so he calls attention to that association. And he also suggests that maybe it could really be understood going in the other direction. Because earlier in Aruch Chaim, in Siman Nun Gimel, so there the Shulchan Aruch talks about if somebody hires a chazan and doesn't specify that there's a specific term of length of employment, but there's a minig that that's the case, that it's understood in that area that this is how people are hired. They're not hired forever. They're hired for a year or 3 years or whatever it is. So then that's binding. That understanding is binding. So over there, the Vilna Gaon had a comment that what you see is that we see this as if they explicitly conditioned it. In other words, there, he's going back to the more nominal specific understanding. Right, the assumption that this is our working premise, that if everyone knows a chazan is hired for 2 years, so then it's as if we said it out loud. And therefore, that's the understanding. So, is that a contradiction? That in the context of Piyutim, it sounds like he's seeing all minhagim as one thing. That basically it's all that we credit what people do as having value. And here, in the context of employment, he's evoking the idea of there being an implicit understanding. So are those two different models of how a minig works? Everyone follow the question? Restate, it's a little confusing. That if we want to pose the question, how do minhagim impact on, let's say, mamonos? Right? So is mamonos totally on minig because that's the implicit understanding, that probably when I hire you, it's under the premise that this is what people normally do and those are the rules? Or is it something more connected to Minhagim B'Cholot Arikua, that we just assume that there's by default significance to what people do? And just like that's true in Shul, and just like it's true in Pasu B'Cholov, so it's also true in the Mamonos world. So, the Vilna Gaon, in one context, he mentions this explicit-implicit relationship, that whatever is the minig hamakom we can assume is our understanding, which is the more momentos-specific kind of explanation. But in the context of the piyutim, so he ties that to the employer-employee source, which makes it sound like the employer-employee source is all also about minhagim, like in the ritual context. So it sounds like there's two different explanations at play here, both coming through the Bir Hagra, both coming through the Vilna Gaon. Zach?
Well, it fits perfectly into our...
Are you named after the Bir Hagra? It's a worthwhile thought. You could jump in on that one. Yeah.
It fits into our earlier conception of the two versions of Minhagim Dinei Mamonos, which is one is common language, and maybe that would fit in with the concept of implicit understanding.
Right.
And whereas importance of what people do, maybe it could be something that falls under communal enactment, or I've been writing it down in my own notes as like local ordinance. Like
ordinance and suggesting intentional policy.
Yes.
Yeah, so is he saying, therefore, two different ideas in two different contexts? One is one and one is the other?
But it seems to say that even though we in Shir establish this as one, as a concept only area of Mamonos, so we can say there may be two conceptions of Minhag overall, but those are universally applied. Like, let's say by ritual, we go back to the idea of Shema B'ni B'Sar Avicha. We can say, okay, that's a nice pasuk, and maybe that's, if we want to go back to Tanakh and say, okay, where does the idea of Minhag arise in the first place? we could sort of chuck that out as a model of Minhag overall and sort of combine our two models of Minhag into one universalistic model of Minhag.
So it's interesting. So it's interesting. So it could still come from a common element and tie in. It's interesting that Rav Asher Weiss in this essay, so he calls attention to both of these comments, so he also suggests it could go in the other way, that the focus on piyutim is specifically because it's what the tzibur does. So essentially it's kind of like we all have to work together, and therefore we all have to have a common understanding of what we're doing. So the tzibur does piyutim in a certain way, so that's what the tzibur should maintain. Now, it's also interesting, he doesn't focus on this, but as we'll see, and we'll talk about this a little bit more in the next few minutes, but the Gemara in Psachim, which is very relevant to issues of Yontif, but the Gemara, starting from the Mishnah and Daf Nun, and the Gemara that follows, so there, the Gemara talks very strongly about Minig, and about the need to stick to a local minig. But the Gemara also connects that to a concern of machlokas, which is also interesting. It could be that that's its own priority, that the need to maintain harmony is a value. And as we know, minhagim can be one of the most prominent sources of people fighting. So because harmony is itself a value, so we should stick to a minig for that reason.
Intentionality.
Yeah, but well, not necessarily. It could just imply that this is what it's like the old joke, you know, when people there was a discussion in the shul board about what to do about a certain issue in tefillah that maybe only came up once in a while, once every few years. So they had a meeting about it in the whole gathering of the shul. They asked one of the oldest members, what did they used to do last time it happened? And he said one way. And they asked another member, he said another way. And they asked another member, he said, they're both right. I remember, we used to fight about it. That's the minig is to fight about it. So people fight about Minhagim more passionately than even things that are in the Torah itself. And that plays both ways. It's also interesting halachically, because we have a prohibition of losis godudu, which we read about in the parasha a few weeks ago, in Parasha Yisra'eh, and a month ago already. And there, that plays out as a prohibition to have visible differences in halachic practice. And it's a whole discussion among the Achronim, among Avraham, and Nitziv, and others, whether that's only in matters of absolute halacha, or does it apply even to issues of minig also. And many poskim assume that it depends. What's the issue of losis godudu? That Rashi in Maseches Yevamos seems to understand that losis godudu is about, we don't want to look like we follow two Torahs. So if there's a visible difference in Psak, it looks like this group has one Torah and that group has another Torah, that's not so good. But other Rishonim, like the Rambam and the Sefer Achinuch, sounds like the issue is because of Machlokas. So we don't want people to fight over the fact that they're doing different things. So therefore, we should maintain consistent policy in things that are visible and overt. So if that's the case, so many of the poskim assume that the question of minig is connected to that. That if it's about not looking like there's two Torahs. So we understand there are different minhagim in the world. So people do things differently because of their different traditions. It doesn't create the impression of two Torahs. But if it's about machlokas, we also understand people very quickly fight over minhagim, so therefore there should be a concern by minhagim also. And this Sri Yeish has a tshuva about this, where he suggests there's actually two different dinim here. There's a din min haTorah of losis godudu, and then there's an additional din midrabanan of this Gemara in Psachim of al yishana ada mishum hamachlokas. So it's an extension on the level midrabanan. But essentially, it's a little bit circular. What it's saying is that we shouldn't fight, we shouldn't have clashes in Minhagim because that will lead to fighting. But maybe what the Gemara is also telling us in that context is that Minhagim are also important to prevent fighting. That we should stick to the Minhag so that we don't have a reason to fight. So it's a little bit of a circular point, but it's maybe each enhancing each other, that we should maintain consistent policies so that there's not going to be a machlokas. So essentially, when you look at something like Piyutim, so we could say that that's not so different from Dinei Mamonos, because essentially you have a group of people who made a shul together, and each one has expectations about what their Yom Kippur is going to look like, or what their Rosh Hashanah is going to look like. So then we should stick to whatever the minhag is, so that one's not going to have a taina against the other. This isn't the kind of shul I envisioned, so this isn't what I joined with my membership to have a shul without these piyutim. It's not what I'm looking for. So it could be that coming from that direction, it's not so fundamentally different. We have a question from the Zoom. Alexander, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Okay.
If we look at the peer team from that model, then if everybody agreed, they could change the minhag.
Yes, that might be the case. That might be the case. That might, so it prompts the question of why are we so connected to it? You know, if it's about not causing a fight, then that might be the case. If it's about the assumption that this has created a certain enhancement of a halachic value, we might be harder to. Now, another question that you're raising, which comes up in a lot of these contexts, and is a pretty big Bava Basra issue overall for some of these things, is you said if everyone agreed. So that's going to be an important question that's going to come up throughout. What level of agreement do you need? Because we have a notion of following the rove, and that's going to come up in a lot of the Bava Basra context as well. But do we always follow the rove, or do we sometimes need absolute, unanimous agreement? And that's going to be a question that once we start to develop something as a right because of prior expectation, so then maybe to take that right away from somebody, you need 100% consensus. That if we've already established that I have a right to a certain expectation, so then if 75% of the shul wants to change it, maybe I can still say, but that's not fair. I came with the expectation that it was this, and that's what I signed up for. And it doesn't matter that most people want to change it. Maybe there is a preference to the default because I have that right coming in. And yeah, we could all agree to change it, but we have to literally all agree. And then that's something you find in the discussion in a lot of these areas. It's going to be an important point to keep in mind. So I don't know if you were being precise in saying everyone agrees, or whether you meant the rubo kukulo, but there's a difference between the two, and that's something that's going to play a role in a lot of these conversations.
Maybe this is getting too ahead, but wouldn't those also be like tell-away on the issue of if it's like a literal agreement, like we all got together and shul took a vote,
mm-hmm.
or it's more like, let's say, like a social contract sort of agreement, like, you know, there is the theoretical we that exists in the ether made this joint decision to, you know.
It might. It's a reasonable chiluk to make. Question whether that always is indeed present is something we'll have to see. But it's certainly logical that you could draw such distinction. But whether that always carries the day, something we'll have to see. So that's one possible suggestion to look at the relationship here between piyutim and employment law, which the Groa is connecting in one place, and employment of a chazan and implicit premises, which he finds in another place, and maybe they're all connected in that direction, perhaps. So in other words, we can join the ritual and the monetary from two different directions. We can say that the tzad hashava is that we just validate by default what people do, not absolutely, but by default. That's one premise that could tie together everything. Or it could come from that direction, that it's about the implicit expectation and understanding, but that affects ritual practice also. That something, if we do things in shul that are in the context of tefillah, but that's also an interpersonal relationship, and that also is going to draw back on whatever our understandings are. Now, very much also related to Yontif is the issue of Yontif Sheni. And the question of, especially nowadays, that travel is in general so much more frequent this year notwithstanding, but overall, travel is much more common between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz than it once was. So the question of B'nai Eretz Yisrael in Chutz La'aretz and vice versa, and what should they do about Yontif Sheni, is a major issue, and a major practical issue for many people going back and forth. And it was a major discussion in Polska. I'm sure you've all dealt with this in your own actual lives. And I'm familiar with the Chacham Tzvi and others, that essentially is a analysis of that Sugya Psachim, where the Gemara talks about Makom Shenagu, if there's a certain place where there is a practice to observe halacha in a certain way, and all kinds of different details. So then, somebody who comes there, when do they follow those practices? When do they stick to the practices where they came from? They have to be machmer for both. So that's that Sugya Psachim, which is very much a part of the Yontif Sheni issue. So what's also relevant, and especially if you're learning Daf Yomi, so a week ago you would have hit Beit Daf Dalet, sure, or if you learned the Makoros today, you would have hit there also, but it was Daf Yomi a week ago. So the Gemara deals with Yontif Sheni in the language of Minig. Although nowadays it's a Din D'Rabbanan, it's been formalized as a Gzeira, but the Gemara connects it to the process of Minig, and the Gemara says, Minig Avoseinu Bi'adenu, that this is something that is a formalization of a practice that once was, and that is continued. Now, the Gemara over there in Beitza adds a sentence there that, technically speaking, we don't seem to need Yontif Sheni nowadays. Right, why did Yontif Sheni come into existence? Because we used to be Mekadesh HaChodesh HaYidei HaRiyah. We used to have every month a process to go through to decide whether a month was going to be 29 days or 30 days. So we didn't know when Rosh Chodesh was going to be, and Rosh Chodesh was going to influence when Yantif was. So the message took time to get around, and therefore we had to have a practice of Sveika D'Yoma, a practice that these places that were further away and wouldn't get the message so quickly, they had to observe 2 days Yantif. So nowadays that's not practical, for two reasons. You know, one reason already this Mani Gemara, another reason much more so nowadays. First of all, we have instant communications nowadays, so you could find out what happens in Yerushalayim literally that second anywhere in the world. So that already creates a different reality. But also, we just don't have Kiddush Al Pi HaRiyah at the moment. We have a calendar that has been established, so we know when Yontif fits. So the whole premise is not really relevant to us, but the Gemara says that we should still do it anyway, and the Gemara says that, who knows, maybe there'll be some kind of a gezeira that's going to interfere, and we're going to need to go back to the way things were. So, what do you think about why the Gemara has all that explanation? Is that just the context? Is there halachic relevance to that explanation? Is there a reason why we need an explanation? So, there is a very interesting, very, very interesting tshuva about this in the writings of the Kadjik Lover Rav. I don't think we mentioned him yet this year, but mentioned him from time to time. The Kadjik Lover Rav, just to give the introduction. So, the Kadjik Lover Rav was the Talmud of the Avnei Nezer. The Avnei Nezer was Sochet Shav Rebbe, who had a very creative approach to learning. So one of his students, he had many students, one of his students was the Kadjik Lover Rebbe, Tzvi Hirsch Frimmer, who wrote the Tshuvas Eretz Tzvi. And you can see a picture of him on the wall of the fifth floor of the library. If you come out of the library or the elevator, you come out to the right, it's a picture of him on the wall, because that floor was dedicated in his memory a number of years ago. He was the Rosh Shiva of Chachmei Lublin, and died during the Holocaust. So he has a very fascinating tshuva, and in the context of that tshuva, so he explains, you know, why does the Gemara have to, and the Rishonim already addressed this a little bit, the Ran and Sukkah and others, why does the Gemara have to explain, well, we should still do it because maybe things will get undone? Why does the Gemara have to explain that? Well, it's very important, right? Because the role of a minhag, as we've mentioned from day one, is that a minhag, yes, has default value, but we also said it's not absolute. And there is such a thing as minhagim that we're not supposed to follow. And why would you maybe not follow a minhag? So either because it's a total mistake, a minhag tos or a minhag shtos, or because it was tied in to a specific set of circumstances that don't have any relevance anymore. So therefore, it's crucial for the Gemara to explain that, no, it's not irrelevant. That we're not just doing what was done historically just because we don't change anything. It could come up again. Who knows? So therefore, it's kedai to keep this policy in effect. And in discussing this, the Kajik Lover notes that this is Tosfos and Bava Basra in their base. Right? Our Tosfos that we saw on the first half of Bava Basra that says you don't just follow every minhag. Right? It's got to have some kind of a basis for it. There are some minhagim that are off the charts. So that's what's being dealt with here. And he points out, and part of the beauty of the whole Sachachavar Kajik Lover approach is it's really something to admire, is the way they see a certain integrity. The Kol HaTorah Kula is everything tied in together. So the relationship between sugyas that is not always so obvious. So here he's pointing out that this Gemara in Beitz is essentially reflecting Tosfos on our Daf, Tosfos and Bava Basra Daf Beis, and that it's also Tosfos and Psachim. So I put on the list this morning to see a Tosfos and Psachim on the top of Daf Nunim and Beis. So there, if you saw, right, Tosfos quotes Yerushalmi, that it said that there were women that had a minhag not to do malacha on Motzei Shabbos. And the language was, that's lav minhaga, that's not a minhag. But to not do malacha until the davening was finished, that was a minhag. So what do you mean, this isn't a minhag and this is a minhag? So he said, it's very brief Tosfos, doesn't say much more than that, just says the first one, lav min haga, the second one is a minhag. So the Kajik Lover, again, Kedarko, ties that. He says, that's King Kosov Tosfos Basra Daf Beis Manal. It's the same Tosfos, the same idea, that not every minhag is, not everything that people do is actually a minhag. It has to have some kind of purpose to it, some kind of significance. So some things people might do, but it's not really a minhag. So it's just to not do malacha Motzei Shabbos is not a minhag. But some things are actual minhagim. So that Tosfos, that very brief Tosfos, where he just has that language there, this is minhag, this isn't a minhag. So the Kajik Lover tells us that that's the same thing Tosfos is saying on Bava Basra Daf Beis Amud Aleph, that not every minhag should be followed. And that's why the Gemara in Beitza has to tell us that there's a reason to keep Yontif Sheni, because it's not stam a relic of some kind of circumstance of history that has no relevance to our lives. It's something that could theoretically be relevant again. And therefore, intentionally, Chazal formalized it and said this is something that we should hold on to. Hi.
So then, what about something like Kidneys?
So Kidneys is a major discussion. That's why it's a major fight. It's amazing how passionate people get about it. But that's a big part of the literature, you know, and that's it's not something which is necessarily obvious one way or another. There are, but there were already those who argued. We're actually about to mention them again in another context, but Yaakov Emden, who argued against the minhag already 200 years ago. Yaakov Emden died in 1776. That's how you remember when the revolution was. He died 250 years ago. So he argued against Kidneys back then, and, you know, clearly he was outvoted, but the conversation keeps coming up. You know, so it's, and it goes to these questions. That's part of the primary issue. So how to relate to it? Does it have any connection still to our lives as manazah, or is it simply a relic of circumstances? So that's a part of the discussion. So you have to prove your case in order to sell anyone on this. I remember I once brought Rav Schechter an article that was arguing that the minhag should be abandoned. So he didn't say right away, oh, that can't be. So let me read it first. Let's see, you know, if it was, didn't find it convincing in the end. But had he found it convincing, maybe it would be what to talk about. But in any event, so that is a ongoing discussion. So essentially, what the Gemara and Beitza is telling us about the fact that maybe circumstances could change again is to make that point that the minhag has to have a continuing connection to something and not be tied to circumstances that are not relevant anymore. Now, to take it a step further, and just to give you a maramakum, and this is something you can read over Yantif, very kedai. So, a part of the beauty of minhagim is that we don't always fully appreciate why they endure, and a part of why we want to be very, very careful in dismissing a minhag is because we may not have the whole picture, both in terms of halacha and hashkafa. So we really need to be convinced that the minhag is completely irrelevant nowadays or was never relevant in order to dismiss it. So in this spirit, so we'll note, so on the one hand, the Gemara is telling us in this reading one reason why Yantif Sheni continues to be relevant. Give you extra marmakum to look at. Rav Shamshon Fal Hirsch, in his commentary to Parshas Bo, Chodesh Zelochem, he's got a long, very beautiful explanation of the hashkafic value of Yantif Sheni and why that is relevant to us for Zvanazah. So that just also highlights that there's so many different dimensions to a minig. Sometimes a minig is there to keep us in line practically. Sometimes it has elements that are hashkafically relevant. So we have to be very, very careful. So here he's adding an extra dimension on top of what we're already seeing. So if one wants to, on the second day of Sukkot, or in Simchus Torah, wants to have a greater appreciation of why they're observing that, recommend picking up a copy of Rav Hirsch and reading his comments on that pasuk of Chodesh Zeh
Lachem.
How
was Yom Tov Sheni established as a minhag?
It was established as a din d'rabbanan after people did it, after our forefathers did it.
Why is it relevant?
The reason they kept it.
It's going to stay around.
Right, but the reason, the Gemara is saying the reason that they formalized it was because it had this potential issue. So what you're explaining is that the reason we needed to highlight this issue is because it wasn't just that Chazal said, okay, here's a minig, just keep it. But Chazal said, keep this minig, and we're telling you to keep this minig because it has continuing relevance.
Most people have a minhag, they didn't want people just
saying, but they didn't
just
want
to, doing any minhag.
No, but it wasn't just that we should respect what they did then. It's that it could, in the point the Gemara is bringing up is that it could come up again. But in addition to that, just mentioning also that Rav Hirsch adds, there's also hashkafic significance to Yantif Sheni. There's a lot written about that also. There are other explanations as to why the Baal HaTanya has in his sefer what the message is of Yantif Sheni. So the whole gets into more mystical ideas, but the notion that history is guided in order to include these extra values is on top of that. But again, so there's many different levels to why there is significance to Yantif Sheni. So the topic that Kudrick Lever was addressing, La Halacha, is also a fascinating question. The reason he was talking about all this is, he said, and if, you know, look, he didn't look at the date of the Shuv, but if we know he died in the Holocaust, so this was sometime before the State of Israel was established. And he was talking about the new settlements in Eretz Yisrael. So areas, he talks about Tel Aviv by name. So if you have an area that is in Israel, but was not a populated settlement in the time of the Gemara, so what should the din be regarding Yantif Sheni? So what is the minig of such a place? It is the minig what was actually done? Or, no, it's the minig of Eretz Yisrael, despite the fact that there weren't any people there at the time. There wasn't a settlement there at the time. So he quotes a tshuva of the aforementioned Rebbe Akivemdin. Comes in again, the Shailas Yavetz, that he thought that the Rebbe Akivemdin thought that new settlements that were not there in the time of Chazal, so that is treated like chutz laretz. That has a din of a minig of Yantif Sheni. Which, as he notes, as you probably could appreciate, it's a huge chiddush. That's a very big chiddush to say. That there should be, we're not talking about a lot, you know, talking about something that is in the borders of Eretz Yisrael according to everybody, but if it wasn't a settlement with a practice in the time of Chazal, so then it should have a din of Yantif Sheni. So he's not actually sure how to conclude on this. He says history will have to decide who's right. But so there is a connection to a machlokes rishonim, which I gave you to look at, that Rabbi Yaakov Emden's position is based on the Rambam. And that the Rambam in Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh, so the Rambam seems to say that even Bizmanehem, that it wasn't across the board that Yantiv Sheni was only in Chutz Laaretz and everything in Eretz Yisrael was one day. It depends practically on what was actually reachable. So that which was reachable and could get the news in time, so they only kept one day Yantiv. And those places, even in Eretz Yisrael, that were farther, so they actually kept 2 days out. And therefore, Yaakov Emden assumes, okay, so if you have a place that wasn't there at all, so then that's in the category like a place that was unreachable. And the Kadosh Lover, in considering this, he says, well, not so sure. Because the Ritva in Rosh Hashanah and Daf Yud Ches, you had a chance to see that. It's a long Ritva, but the last paragraph I think I highlighted on the list to take a look at. The last paragraph, the Ritva says that we go basarov, that it wasn't just about the reality of what was reachable and what wasn't reachable, that most of Eretz Yisrael was reachable. So therefore, Rov determines, and all of Eretz Yisrael only has one day on it. And in Chutz Laaretz, even if you had a place that was reachable, but most of Chutz Laaretz was not, so therefore we have a policy of Yontif Sheni across the board in Chutz Laaretz. So we draw the line at the border of the land of Israel because we follow Rov. So whatever is inside, yes, whatever is outside, no. So he goes through it, the Kadosh Baruch Hu says, so then it seems like the Ritva disagrees with the Rambam, so maybe we should follow the Ritva, but on the other hand, the Ritva doesn't quote the Rambam, so maybe he wasn't aware of the Rambam's position, so we shouldn't say we just follow the later opinion. So he goes back and forth about this. But he also asserts that it's not so clear that the comparison is correct. To say that the Rambam says places that you couldn't reach kept 2 days, so therefore a new settlement should also keep 2 days. Doesn't think that's necessarily true, because there is a process here of the Din D'Rabbanan formalizing a minig. So there had to have been a minig beforehand. So when there was existing practice of there being Yontif Sheni, so then, okay, we said we'll continue this practice and we'll formalize it into a din. So it's not necessarily comparable. The Rambam says, okay, if there was a place that was keeping 2 days Yontif, even in Eretz Yisrael, so then maybe they would have a minig also nowadays that would be formalized. But if there was no community there, then they weren't observing any such minig. So then we don't have a reason to say that nowadays we should impose that from nowhere. So to bring everything together, the Gemara says in Beitza that we should keep Yontif Sheni because, who knows, things could get undone. That means where you have a minig, so we should keep it going and we formalize it into a Din D'Rabbanan. But if there is no such minig, then we don't necessarily impose that onto the situation. So a place in Eretz Yisrael that didn't exist at the time and was in Eretz Yisrael anyway, so there was no precedent for them keeping 2 days Yontif. So there's no reason to say that we should ask them to keep 2 days today. And he notes in that context, the Ran and Sukkot says that the whole process of formalizing Yontif Sheni only happened because it's on top of the existing minig, and if you don't have the minig, so then you wouldn't have had that premise to formalize it the way it was. Okay, so far so good? Fascinating stuff. Okay, so to continue, we'll go a few more minutes, we'll have to spill into tomorrow a little bit, but to continue, really topics relevant to yesterday and to this topic. So the notion of a minig as its binding power, especially in the context of ritual, is very possibly connected to the notion of neder that we spoke about yesterday. Right? So yesterday we talked about the practice of Hataras Nedarim and Kol Nidre, and how they're there to address the concern that we might be in violation of our commitments. And as we noted, I mean, how likely is it? We probably remember, especially if we're careful not to take nedarim anyway, we probably remember if we did take a nedar, why do we all have to worry about this? So as we noted, it's not just about explicit nedarim. There is also the possibility that you have a hanhaga that is also a binding commitment. And therefore, we should worry about that too. So the source for that is a Gemara, right? The Gemara in Nedarim, Adaf Tesvav. You had a chance to see that this morning, right? So what does the Gemara suggest in that context? That there is a application of Bal Yachel, L'Yachel Devaro, that pasuk in the beginning of Parshas Matos, there is an application that is on a level Midrabanan. And what is the example of that? So the Gemara is coming off a different example in order to get into the conversation, but the Gemara also brings up what's a violation of Bal Yachel on a level Midrabanan. So something that is theoretically mutter, but acherim nagu iser, people have taken on a practice not to do it. So then to contradict that would be a violation of Bal Yachel on a level midrabanan. So here, the Gemara seems to be associating on some level, minhagim, or maybe some minhagim, with the concept of nether. Now here it sounds like it's explicit that it's drabanan. Why should it be drabanan and not daraisa? Any suggestions? Why is the Gemara assuming it's drabanan? Well, no one's saying anything, so maybe that's the answer, because no one says anything. So if it's not explicit, if we normally assume that a neder requires to be spoken, so if nothing was spoken, so then it shouldn't really qualify for lo yachel devaro, there were no dvarim, nothing was said. So the idea that it has any connection to this is harder to see in the pasuk itself, so maybe that's why it's a derabbanan. That's how the Chida explains and others explain. That's why the Gemara calls it Rabban. There's a tshuva of the Chassam Sofer that's widely quoted that is a little perplexing from this perspective, because the Chassam Sofer seems to write that because of the nether effect of this minig, so one who violates a minig like this, whichever minhagim fall in this category, is actually in violation of an Isser Daraisa, the Neder. So the later Svarim ask on him from both halves of the sentence. First of all, the Gemara seems to say it's Drabanan. And the reason that it's Drabanan, according to these explanations, is because it's not spoken. So that's itself its own question. So if one didn't actually say anything, why would he be in a Torah violation of a Neder if he's contradicting what he didn't say in the first place? So it seems to be a pretty significant difficulty. Some explain, Tshuva the Maram Shik. The Maram Shik was one of the Talmidim of Hakim of the Chassam Sofer, Rav Moshe Shik. So he suggests that maybe what we're talking about is something where your behavior of commitment to this minuk is clear and overt, and therefore it's as if it was expressed. And when that's not true, when the details don't fit that, so nechadami. So if it's not so clear and overt, it will only be drabanan. But if you have a situation where your behavior really establishes that this is what you're committing to do in a visible way, so then that is ki'ilu, it's spoken, and that's why it should be treated like a nether daraisa. So that could be what the Chassam Sofer is getting at. Again, many poskim don't assume that that's true. Still, that sounds still sounds like it should be a drabanan, but to explain where the Chassam Sofer is coming from, that's one possible approach. Question with that? Yeah. So that opens up a lot of questions. So first of all, so again, to go to yesterday's discussion, so does Hataras Nedarim work for such a practice, say on a personal level. So can somebody do Hataras Nadarim on such a hanhaga? So that was the Machlokas Rishonim, that the Gemara has the language of not being matir this behavior. So does that mean you can't do Hataras Nadarim? That's what it sounds like the literal translation is. So the Rush writes, no, it doesn't mean that. It means that we shouldn't allow it, stop. But if you have a process of Hataras Nadarim with Harata and the like, so then, like any other neder, it should work. It just means, when it says Lo Yatiradu Lo, it means we shouldn't allow him to do it without going through the process. But if one has the process of Hataras Nadarim, it would work on this minig as well. The Rashba has a tshuva, though, where he says differently. And the Rashba writes that he thinks, no, that maybe this is more chumer than a normal neder. Because if we're talking about something that is a reflection of some kind of a halachic value, so when we have a normal Hataras Nadarim, so that's when somebody takes a neder that's just on a random topic. So he'll be bound to whatever he commits himself, but if he does the Hataras Nadarim, that will undo it. But if there's something which is a fulfillment of a din, so maybe that's stronger than a regular neder, and it's not subject to Hataras Nadarim. Now, if you saw in the Shulchan Aruch, they could put that on the list, in Reish Yudalid and Yerodeah, so there the Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch records this din of the Gemara Nadarim, that something that's taken on as Anhaga has the status of a neder and a Lava Midrabanan. And the Shulchan Aruch brings both views about whether there could be Hatara, and seems to side with the first view, that yes, there can be Hatara by this as well. We'll have to continue this tomorrow. There's a lot more to say about it, but I'll just mention one point. So, in this context, Halach L'maisa, Rav Shechter often cites the position of the No de Bihuda in his commentary, Dogma Mervava, which was also a big COVID issue, a big COVID position, that the Dogma Mervava seems to say, to explain a psak of the Shulchan Aruch, where he says that if somebody has the practice of not eating on Bahab, on the Monday, Thursday, Monday after Yantif, and then there's a bris, he could eat at the bris. So the No de Bihuda basically explains it's a combination of things that doesn't need a Hataras Nadarim for that. I could do it without Hataras Nadarim. And he explains the combination of two things. You know, one is that the circumstances are clearly different than his premise. And normally it's not where there's a bris. But also, he's not looking to free himself of this practice forever. It's just right now, in the context of the circumstance. So, if he wants to say, I want to give up this practice forever, okay, so he'll need Hataras Nadarim to release himself. But just this limited circumstance, where it's also clear why it's different from what he originally expected, so that he shouldn't need even Hataras Nadarim. He should be able to do that without Hataras Nadarim. And that's influenced by the fact that we're not really talking about an actual neder here, we're talking about a drabanan application of Bal Yachel. So this came up a lot over the course of the past year. Shechter quoted this Dogma Mervava often in his tshuvas about COVID, that when a person had a hanhaga, which the COVID situations made difficult to observe, so then he wouldn't even need Hataras Nadarim because he's not looking to give up this practice forever. It's because of the difficulties of the circumstance. And it's only during that situation that he wants to not follow that minhag. So he would often invoke that Dogma Mervava and say that that's not a circumstance where you need Hataras Nadarim. It's self-evident that this is not included in the original commitment and it wouldn't be even the violation of the Rabbanan of Bal Yachel. So a lot more to say about this. I guess we'll spill over into tomorrow, hopefully better. But just to quickly recap what we spoke about today. So we spoke about a few things. We spoke about the relationship between Minhagim in the context of Mamanos and in the context of other areas of Halacha, and how the Gra seems to be making two different statements about the Piyutim associating that with employee law, and about employee law associating that with implicit understandings, and we noted how that could be understood in a different direction, that maybe it's all about implicit understandings, but also piyutim is something that's done in a group, is done in the shul, and therefore the implicit understandings matter there also, because people are obligated to be working together. And we talked a little bit about that overall, about how the Gemara in Psachim emphasizes the importance of sticking to the minig and mentions machlokis in the context of that. So that's also got kind of a synergistic relationship with itself, that we want to stick to minhagim to avoid machlokis, and we avoid machlokis by not messing with the minhagim. So the whole question of losis go to do and whether it applies to minhagim is the understanding of many achronim contingent on that question. If losis go to do is about machlokis, davka, that's a reason to apply it to minhagim, and this radiation that Shulver says an extra prohibition of Rabbanan of not deviating from machlokis because of that, not deviating from minhagim because of machlokis, because of that basic understanding. And then we talked about Yantif Sheni a lot, and the whole discussion of Yantif Sheni is surrounding that Gemara in Psachim about Malkam Shinagu, and the Gemara in Beitza connects the existence of Yantif Sheni to originally a Minig Avoseinu Biyadeinu that was formalized. And the Gemara explains in Beitza maybe things could get undone, so we should keep it up. And as the Kajal ever explains, that the Gemara tells us that to show that it's not a minig that's irrelevant. And because Tosus and Baba Basra tells us not all minhagim are real, and Tosus and Psachim also seems to be saying that as well, that not every minig is a minig. So therefore, we have to understand that the minig Yantif Sheni we could have said originally made sense, but maybe it was only contextually dependent. So therefore, the Gemara tells us that no, there's a reason to keep it around, and that's necessary for the process. And I mentioned to look at Rifershu, adds a more hashkafic elements to it as well, Balatani and others, so there's added elements also, but that all is reflected in the notion of Yantif Sheni. And the topic of the tshuva was new settlements in Eretz Yisrael that weren't there at the time, should they have a Yantif Sheni or not? He tied it into the Machlokas, the Rambam, and the Ritva, bad settlements in the time that were too far to be reached in time, and is that relevant? That was a whole discussion. And then we got into a little bit this question of Minag Mishum Neder, that the Gemara in the Nedarim seems to say is a violation of Bayachal Midrabanan, if one would violate Hanhaga. And the Chassam Sofer position, maybe even Midaraisa, talked about different distinctions there, and the question of whether that works for a Taurus Nedarim, Machlok is Rishonim, the two days in Shulchan Aruch, but it seems to follow the first view that a Taurus Nedarim does work, and the position of Dagmar Vava that was very relevant over the past 2 years, that when the circumstances are very clear that this is not what you had in mind, and you're only looking to skip the minig right now under these circumstances, you don't even need Hataras Nadarim for that. Okay, so I have to see a little bit more about Sashim tomorrow. We'll be in touch about the details about that, and everyone should have a wonderful day. Should be all the good things, and see you soon.